The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Rodrigo, what do you think of shrimp and pasta stew?
That sounds pretty good.
You like garlic skillet meatballs?
Yeah.
What did you have for dinner tonight?
I had a hot dog.
A hot dog?
Yeah.
Do you know what is in a hot dog?
No. And I prefer to keep it that way.
Okay. Here's what you need to do. You need to go to HelloFresh.com. Okay. HelloFresh.com has everything you need to make a good, healthy meal like apricot glazed chicken in 35 minutes or less. Cooking made easy. Here's what happens. Every week, the chefs at HelloFresh create delicious recipes. You pick what you like. So maybe you don't like apricot glazed chicken, although I know you like apricots.
And chicken.
And chicken. Perhaps you would like, I don't know, something vegetarian. They have vegetarian meals. You pick them out. What they do is they send all the ingredients that you need to make something delicious directly to your door. Great ingredients, farm fresh ingredients, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Wow.
It's right there at your door. You cook it, you make it, you eat it. You're not eating hot dogs. You're not eating fast foods. You're not... Bleh.
And I'm glad they don't have hot dogs, because if they send you all the ingredients of a hot dog, that would be pretty terrible.
Listeners, you can visit HelloFresh and check out if they deliver in your area. And when you use the checkout code MAJOR50, check this out. You get 50% off your first weekly delivery.
50%?
50% off just by using the checkout code MAJOR50. That's HelloFresh.com. We thank them for supporting this episode of Zach on Film.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. After a long trip from Paris, you have landed in a city, hoping to luck your way into a flight to Lisbon with a final destination of America. While you wait, listen to this week's episode of Zach on Film as we talk Casablanca.
Hey, Zach, you notice anybody familiar in this movie, Casablanca, 1942?
Two people.
Just two?
There's probably more, but that's who stuck out originally.
Okay.
We have Humphrey Bogart.
Okay.
Back in the main role.
Where have you seen him before?
We have seen him in The Maltese Falcon.
Okay.
And then we have Peter Lorre, who gets taken out of the film early on. We have seen him in M.
And?
The Maltese Falcon.
And? Okay.
And Casablanca.
Okay. And who else?
That's all I really noticed.
The fat man who runs the coffee shop, also from Casablanca?
Or was he also from Maltese Falcon?
Maltese Falcon. And then the guy at the beginning who is flashing the secret underground ring. Do you know where he's from?
No, I don't.
I'm almost positive that he is the forger from The Great Escape.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which guy?
The guy that is the underground movement guy that's flashing the ring. He's like, hey, would you be interested in buying a ring? And he's really trying to let the two characters know that he's part of the underground movement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hmm. So give us a rundown of this movie, Zach.
So what Casablanca is about is Casablanca is this kind of stopover spot during World War II for people trying to escape occupied France and make their way over to America. And while there, we see Rick, who owns a little cafe pub thing, tavern. Mm-hmm. And a lot of shady things happen in Casablanca because people are trying to get papers to get out of this country to escape to America and leave the war. And so there's a lot of black market things going on, and we open up, and two German post carrier soldier kind of guys got murdered. And their papers that would allow someone to leave for America were stolen. And these are very valuable in Casablanca because getting one of those visas to leave is hard to come by and can generally cost a lot of money.
Yes.
And then some resistance fighters for France end up in Casablanca with what's his name? Lutzel?
Lulz?
Lulz? I don't remember.
L-O-L-Z?
Laszlo?
Yeah, Laszlo. He's high up on the Third Reich's kind of hit list because he's escaped concentration camps before, and he's avoided capture and escaped from them multiple times, and he's kind of a leader guy in this underground resistance. And so the Germans, they're there, one of the leaders of the Third Reich is there to follow up on this murder and to make sure he doesn't escape. And then there is a love story between Humphrey Bogart's character and another lady that stems all the way back to Paris, because they always have that. And there's a nice little love story in there, and it all ends kind of nicely walking away in the fog.
He kind of skipped over a bunch of stuff.
Well,
there.
I mean, yeah.
What did he skip over? That's kind of the crux of the story, Rodrigo.
The crux of the love story is that you kind of don't know if Rick, Humphrey Bogart's character, is going to help this other guy who is the husband of the girl he's in love with escape to America, if he's going to turn him in, and then he's going to take off with the girl, if he's just going to leave him there and take off with the girl, if he's just going to send the girl. Like, you just don't know exactly what he's going to do. Meanwhile, there's a lot of pressure being applied because the Germans are there.
Right.
There's a garrison, basically, from the Third Reich just hanging out there. And a very important character, there's this corrupt French official who is not going to stick out for anybody. Like, whoever has the upper hand, that's kind of the team that he's playing for.
Right.
Just a quick clarification. It's not Donald Pleasance. It's Donald Quinlan, who I was mistaken, or John Quinlan, who I was mistaken as the same character. They look a lot alike from the younger days and from
profile. They very much do, actually, because I thought that myself.
So here's the thing. If I were to ask you, Zach, who is the most virtuous person in this movie? Who is the most righteous? Who is the innocent person in this whole movie? Who would you pick?
The most innocent person in this movie would probably be Mr. Resistance Man.
Why?
Laszlo.
I can't remember his name.
Why?
Well, Laszlo never really double crosses anyone. He kind of has his agenda and just kind of goes with it. I don't know. Everyone kind of sucks in this movie to an extent.
Everybody is bad in Casablanca. Yeah. There is not a, you know, I would say it would be very hard to find a virtuous person.
You know who was in good all of in Casablanca? This movie is the young couple trying to escape Casablanca.
No, they're even wrong.
No.
He is gambling their savings so he can bribe the government official so they can get their papers. But she is willing to sleep with police chief so that they can get out.
There is one virtuous person in Casablanca. And they keep yelling at him because of the song he keeps playing.
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah. If there's one person who's pretty much on the level, it's Sam.
It's Sam. Yeah. But, you know, he comes and goes. He's like in there for like the first 30 minutes in the movie and then he's gone.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very interesting.
Sam's more of a plot device than really a character a lot of the time.
What I found interesting about Sam's character is you're right. He is probably the most virtuous person. He just wants to, hey, no trouble. Hey, let's let it go. Hey, let's not dredge up these things. But what's weird is up until Rick yells at Sam to get out and go home, he's like in every scene because he's the musical number in the piece. I mean, we know that those two are tied to the waist in Paris. And yet the minute things get tough, he disappears from the whole movie in that second half of the movie, which I found very, very strange because if you would think that if Rick is about to go on the lam, Sam would be right there with him.
Well, in the end, I mean, and that's true because I think, in fact, the main reason why Sam is there as a character is to bring things out of Rick.
Right.
And to a lesser degree, Elsa. And that's the thing is like once he's done extracting the exposition from the characters, he disappears. And then he just gets mentioned, right?
Right.
He goes to the guy who runs the Blue Parrot, Rick does, mm-hmm. and he arranges for Sam to do this, but he has no agency there. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't get a say as to whether the cafe closes or who it belongs right. to or whatever.
Right.
He literally, like, property gets passed to somebody else, mm-hmm. and then Rick beats it out of town.
Right. Which, yeah. Obviously, the police chief is a very bad person. Mm-hmm. Hey, all the pretty ladies, let's make sure that they get into some dire straits to where they have to come to me for help, and then I will sleep with them and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's definitely, you can bribe him. He is, throughout the entire movie, very, I don't want to say sympathetic, but he is, he has no hatred for the Germans.
Right.
And, of course, the Germans are just like they're doing in Vichy, France. Just telling him what to do, and he has to do it. Hey, close down this cafe. Why? Well, you'll think of some reason. He just says this bar's closed. So he's not a good person. Ilsa,
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going
gambling.
On.
Oh, here's your cut of the takes. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
That's a great line.
Oh yeah.
And there. Well, we'll get back to some of the dialogue here in a little bit. Ilsa is not, you know, innocent. I mean, she's having an affair. Now, granted, she thought her husband was dead.
Sure.
And she was all right. alone. And then as soon as she found out that he was alive, she went back with him. But, you know, she's not innocent in all this.
For the main character, she might be the most innocent.
No, I don't think so.
She's ready
to leave her husband.
Ready to leave her husband after she thought he was dead and developed a relationship. Once she found out he was alive, left the relationship and went back to her husband virtuously.
She's
and then was willing to kill his love, kind of.
She's
to go
considering
back.
Leaving her husband. I mean, when we say virtuous, I don't think virtuous is the thing we're looking at here. Everybody in this film has an ambiguity to their morality. But even if you look at her, she's never played as malicious.
Yeah.
I mean, she loves her husband. She loves Rick.
Mm-hmm.
She considers leaving her husband for Rick. I don't necessarily think that she's ready to leave her husband anymore.
Oh,
than,
she does. You know, I mean, that's why at the very end when Rick's like, you're getting on that plane, she's like, but I thought we were going to run away.
She's considering it. She wants both things. Even Renault at the end of the film where, you know, Captain Renault could lock Rick away and throw him off. And by the way, they said concentration camp in this movie. And holy crap, that scared me. I don't remember that line from any previous viewing. But, you know, even Renault at the end – he's ambiguous. It's not that he's out to get Rick. It's not that he's necessarily even a good law enforcer. He just has things that he does where he will go back and forth across that line of morality.
Right. But I think that at the end, especially for the inspector, he has a real change of, well, you shot a German. That does mean that people can't stand up to these guys without repercussions, and I'm going to help you escape, and we're going to go do our own adventure somewhere else. It's not like they walked off into the fog, and he's mm-hmm. going to continue being the chief of police, right, and right, he's going to continue to own his cafe, because
right.
they got to go on the lam after this.
Yeah.
But something has to change. And even the part about Rick, why is Rick forced to stay in Casablanca and can't go home to America? We don't know. Why are these characters in these straits? It's very, very ambiguous. It's left up to us to make our own thing. So I don't necessarily look at this movie as a question of who's virtuous and who's not virtuous. To some degree, everybody makes at least one vaguely heroic move in the movie, with the exception, of course, of the Nazis. And I think that should tell you something about where this movie is coming from. They're not necessarily looking at this, and I'm kind of surprised at the stuff they got away with under. Would this be under Hays Code?
No, that would be 1942. So
okay,
it'd certainly fall under a production code.
Yeah,
at that point. But yeah, I mean, there's what I'm getting at is don't look at any of these characters as shining examples of how we should lead our lives. People are always like, oh, I want to be Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. Oh, you want to cheat people? You want to mm-hmm. sleep around? You want to?
Get in bed with the corrupt government,
you know,
really trustworthy guy
yes.
in a scummy part of town
he's only looking out
and
for himself.
That's
but
an interesting thing.
The nice thing is he does have this little heart of gold that
right.
with the return of Ilsa, the mm-hmm. little warmth in his heart starts to shine through, especially mm-hmm. when the girl comes up and says, oh, do you think I should sleep with this guy? Is it okay? Is he going to keep his word? And Rick basically works it out to where he gives the guy money.
Right.
And it's all, in his mind, above the board. And everyone goes scot-free. And then, of course, he has the big change of heart saying, hey, the three of us don't amount to a hill of beans. You know, we are less important than what's going on in this world thing. Now I want to get back involved with this.
And the reason I think people would gravitate towards, oh, I want to be Humphrey Bogart, or I want someone like Humphrey Bogart in my life, is because the scene where he gets all the money for the couple so they can get their visas to leave, and then his final decision at the end to let them leave, are such dynamically opposed to everyone else's actions in this entire movie that they're get a huge spotlight shown on them. Like, everyone in his cafe is like, oh, I can't believe you did this, because no one is nice in Casablanca ever.
Right. Well, and especially, and they've never seen Rick be nice to anyone.
Right. And so, and when that stuff like that happens in romance movies, people kind of will forget the crappy part of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen 500 Days of Summer?
Yes, just
before Levitt was, he talked about girls have always said, oh, they would want to date someone like his character in that movie. And he's like, no, you're all insane. He's one of the most selfish people that I've ever portrayed in a movie. He's horrible. Why would anyone want this? It's because there are certain scenes where there's it's a cute scene when they're shopping at IKEA, and that's great. No, I would love to do that. And now, you have to block out other stuff.
The thing with Casablanca is that I think to say is like, well, he's a criminal and he's like in bed with a corrupt government or whatever. The movie does a great job of establishing a world in which there's only two types of people. There's
the Nazis and everyone else.
Yeah, the Nazis and everyone else. It's like the Nazis. It's like if the government is corrupt, then a criminal can be a hero.
Right.
And that's the deal with Casablanca is, you know, when people say that they want to be or that they look up to that character, it is because, you know, he is secretly a softy. You know, they talk about his cafe being a place where a lot of papers do get moved around. And he's like, oh, I never get involved. But he clearly fosters it.
Right, right.
You know, from the beginning, Renault pegs him as a sentimentalist, and he can tell from the very beginning. He's like, you are, by the end of this movie, you're gonna do something stupid. and he does, and he totally does. I mean, in a lot of ways, Renault's kind of the chorus, because he's not really involved until the very end. He just kind of does what he's told, but he's the one who says, oh, that's, you're breaking precedent. Oh, that's weird. Oh, that's never happened before. Hey, everybody, these are the Germans.
Well, and I think what's important about the Renault character is that he has to be the observer, the constant observer, if he's going to keep a control over Casablanca. So, yeah, he's corrupt official, but he has to keep his hands and his fingers in all the pots of what's going on. Otherwise, he loses complete control, and it makes it that much easier for the Germans to just move in and take over Morocco. So, yeah, I mean, there's that from the story. I just brought that up because it's like, well, you know, we do have to realize that these people are not not fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But there, I think there are some, you know, I think it is admirable that Rick would just say, hey, man, go ahead and bet on 22. And that's the secret code word to let the guy win and get all this money. That's great. I like that. I mean, I do like the character of Rick.
Well, and all of his employees love him, right? Early on, you can tell. And like, at no point does he abuse them or bother them.
He's very fair.
He's very helpful to them. Like, the bar gets closed down and he sends them home with pay.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I'm not saying he's a villain. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying he's a villain or that he's a bad person.
The movie
I just don't think that he's an innocent person.
Well, no, because he's an adult.
Right.
The movie does a great job of creating a situation in which a criminal is the guy you're rooting for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it shows you that everyone else is worse than him.
Right. Right. And except I think they do a good job.
Except for the people that he's helping, except for, you know, Laszlo, who's like just this freedom fighter, and, you know, the girl that they're both chasing after, who is also kind of a freedom fighter.
You know, you mentioned that they've built this world. You know, the writers, the director, everybody, I think not only built this world, well, they literally built this world because it was all shot in a soundstage.
Sure.
But I've watched this movie a dozen times, and it's only this time that it really clicked on me that there are the four main characters. Mm-hmm. Then you've got your tertiary characters of Carl, the bar waiter, and then the Germans and all this stuff. But there's a whole world of tertiary characters
yeah. mm-hmm.
that keep popping up again and again. Yep, and you yep. can follow that young married couple throughout the whole movie
yeah.
and watch their whole flight to freedom. The old couple, you get to see what they're doing. You get to see what the underground movement is doing throughout the whole thing. I watched it this time. I was like, holy crap, this world is... I love how they weaved all these minor character stories throughout yep. the piece mm-hmm. to where you get something that is greater than just
yeah.
Rick Elsa and Laszlo.
It's not hugely important, but you start hearing about the Blue Parrot mm-hmm. from the beginning, like an hour before you ever go to that location. In fact, while I was watching this, I didn't remember whether we ever made it to the Blue Parrot or not. I just thought there was always going to be this thing that got mentioned. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, the action does go there. And I was like, oh. I bet that parrot wasn't actually blue when they shot it, but it's fucking white, so who cares?
They did color it in the 80s of one of those Ted Turner things, so maybe it was blue by the time they got that.
They would have.
That's the first time I saw this movie, actually.
Was colorized?
It colorized in the 80s, and I watched because I'm like, well, what is this colorizing thing? I'm going to check this out.
I really liked how they just weaved a very complex character stories throughout this entire thing.
Well, I really liked the pickpocket guy.
Yes.
Because he establishes in the very beginning that they just round up the normal people, anything that happens, and then steal the guy's wallet.
Yeah.
And then it gives us the moment where he steals another guy's wallet at the end, and then he bumps the maitre d' kind of guy, and he checks his wallet, and then it lets us know at the end when he says round up the usual suspects, like this is something they normally do.
Yes.
And it was nice.
Yeah, it was cool. And going over to the dialogue, there are some, like, they don't come out and say, I had an affair, or I slept with him, or anything mm-hmm. like that. But there are some things that are mentioned that I'm sure people in the day were like, oh, ha ha ha. And that the code people just didn't understand. It's like, Renault is like, oh, I've been watching Laszlo more closely, or something along those lines. And Rick says, oh, I didn't know that he was that open-minded, meaning that not only is he sleep with women, but he's also interested in men now too. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, whoa, that got by a censor board of some type of the time period. And I found that very surprising. Sure. There's just some other dialogue that just really stood out as, wow, that is, I'm surprised that got through any kind of a review board.
Oh, yeah.
Did you notice those things, Zach?
No, not really.
Go back. Go.
Oh, well, there you go. You should have a feature in censorship.
What were you going to say, Matthew? Were there some bits that surprised you too?
There are bits that surprised me, not necessarily dialogue related, but yeah, the stuff that they got away with in here. And I know that, you know, they make a point of saying that, oh, she thought Laszlo was dead, but there's that line where she's like, he was my husband then, just like now. And I'm like, ooh, you know, out of context, you've just said that Ingrid Bergman was sleeping around in Paris.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there are some references.
Well, and Laszlo asks her, he goes, were you lonely? And she's like, yes. He goes, I know what loneliness feels like. So there's almost this implication I've done the same thing too. It's okay.
Yeah. And there are some interesting references. And again, for 1942, I'm always surprised when I put this in its actual place in history. There's a lot of stuff here referring to, you know, what was going on in World War II. This is right in the middle of the war. Yeah.
Well, in fact, the original, some of the original crew members actually left the production of Casablanca because the actual production started right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So the movie was in the process of production. Mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor happens, and then a lot of people left to go work on Why We Fight, the documentary, what is it called? The promotional
propaganda
film, film that mm-hmm. John Ford. I forget who did that. Look it up, Zach. Why
okay.
We Fight.
Okay.
But they had to leave that, and they had to bring in a whole new group of people to work on this film. So yeah, that's the crazy thing is the studio is telling a story of things that are happening within the last couple of years in Europe, and it suddenly becomes a war movie.
Yeah,
of sorts, instead of just a romance movie about all that craziness that's going on in Europe.
Yeah, my brain always wants to place this as a post-war film, right, or a movie right. made post-war about what just happened. And this is, I mean, this is a really, really strong piece that happened right in the middle of the war. I honestly did not know and didn't realize until this particular watching that the concentration camps were known to be a thing in 1942. The point where Rick and Renault are talking, they're like, he's like, I'll be in a concentration camp. Renault is like, I'm afraid they'd insist.
What were they called here in America? Detainment centers?
Yes. Relocation.
Relocation
camps.
Centers or whatever they were. Relocation camps. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not a big stretch.
But the other thing is that they're not in the United States. They're not in the Americas.
Right.
So they are someplace that's full of refugees. So people have escaped concentration camps and gone to Casablanca. Makes sense.
Well, I think what Matthew's getting at is he's just surprised that in American film that they would know that these concentration camps are there. But if you think about up. You know, and I'm not a huge history person, so take this in that light. Mm-hmm. A concentration camp is a concentration of people. Even as Americans, we can say in 1942, there are concentration camps where they're putting prisoners of war. We still did not know of the true
The
horrors that were going
on. It's possible that after World War II, the word concentration camp took a different meaning.
Frank
and of
Capra.
Course
Frank Capra, there you go, thank you.
And of course the sequence where Laszlo is like, play the Marseillaise, that is incredibly powerful for me.
Yeah.
You know, knowing what I know about the people in that sequence.
And it's interesting to see kind of where this movie fits into the kind of that American raw arc that movies have really taken on, because although you do have an American at the center of things, there are no other Americans. Everyone else is European who's mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And the big rallying song is not it's not the American national anthem, it's the French national anthem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it gets a big moment. And it's, you know, even if you've never heard the Marseillaise before, like, it sounds like it literally turns the tide of the movie.
Right. Yeah, because at that point the Germans are like, look what happens. We can't even let this guy stay in Casablanca.
Right.
Because look what he's doing here. What we've got to take care of him. We got to take him out now.
Right.
I mean, they just don't know what to do with him. Yeah. They just want to kill him.
And it shows. I mean, that scene is really good.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not just the French people singing it.
It's everybody.
They establish that there are people from Poland, people mm-hmm. from all these other places. There's that guitar player
right.
who she's singing in Spanish, so I assume she's Spanish.
Right.
It's not
a stretch to go from Spain to Morocco.
Yeah. And she sings along with mm-hmm. the Marseillaise. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like everybody who's not on the German side rallies around this song.
You know, if you were going to say that, you know, where's the propaganda in this film? That is the big propaganda movie. Just so, again, we have to strike home that these Germans can't get away with this, even though it's not American.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a French song to propagandize the war and show that we need to be involved in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What else, Zach, do you want to bring into this conversation at this point?
Just story-wise, I thought it was interesting how many foreign languages they used in this film with mm-hmm. no subtitles at mm-hmm. all. I mean, they do the flashback to France, and you're getting, I believe it was German over the bullhorns,
yes.
and they mm-hmm. kind of summarize at the end, but, I mean, they talk for a while. They didn't really speak much to it. I mean, you kind of get a gist of what's happening. There's a bunch of Italian guys that just ramble through scenes and say
stuff.
That
was the greatest part, where you have, like, the Italian and the French guy, mm-hmm. the two officers, are just arguing back and forth with one another as they walk through the scene each and every time. It's just like, that is brilliant. That was really well done.
I mean, even when they're singing the French national anthem, you have no idea. I have no idea what they're saying because it's all in French. And I realized they were singing the French national anthem eventually after they start yelling Viva France.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume they were singing the German national anthem.
They were just singing some German song.
It was a German socialist party song.
Yay, Reich.
Yeah.
In... a lot of, I mean, what you've kind of said, hit on it a couple times, and what I've read online is people say this is one of the movies that just gets better and better every time you watch it, even though it kind of has this simplistic storyline, and to a degree, it just hits on everything so well from the way that studio movies are being made at the time that it just surpasses everything that happened. And obviously their expectations when they made the movie of how they thought it was going to do and surpassed all that.
The first time I watched this was in college, and it was, must have been on a Friday or Saturday night, and I can't remember if it was Smoky Hill or just another non-network television channel. But they would run like classic movies at like 11 o'clock at night, 12. Well, it'd have to be later than that because it'd have to be after regular news. But I remember just flipping through the channel one night and going, oh, Casablanca, I should finally sit down and watch this. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I've since then, over the last 25 years, I've watched it about a dozen times. And I got to say, this is the time that I found it the most pleasant experience that I've had with the story. The most engaging. I got the most out of it. I knew more about the history of what was going on at the time and the importance. And you can read a lot more of the subtlety. And maybe I just wasn't paying attention to so much other stuff because it was always like, oh, it's this love story between these two people. But I think it's the everything surrounding that love story that really makes this an entertaining and engaging movie and makes it feel really, really complete for some reason. So, one of the things why this may feel a little international, Zach, and kind of move into this topic that we'll get to here in just a minute, is you have to remember that your director and cinematographer are both European and had immigrated over to the United States in the, you know, about the same time Peter Lorre and all these other guys were escaping Germany and Hungary and all these places was to get out of there. And they're trying to find work. And here they come in and they do a movie like this. Let me give you a little tease before we get into our list of sponsors here. The director of photography for this movie, Arthur Edson, Casablanca came out in 1942. 1941, there was another movie that he worked on. We'll tell you what that movie was in just a moment.
Okay, let's give a shout out to our associate producers. They are this week Peter Jeunesse, Douglas Connors, John Luckett, Ray Arvid Gregerson, John Alderman, Jason LeClaire, Jason Fowler, Kyle Von Haren, Sigborn Ickness, Tan Kenneth, George Ward, Robert Taylor, Benjamin Witt, Scott Santos, and Andre Dickinson. Thank you one and all for donating to Major Spoilers and being our associate producers this week on Zach on Film.
So Arthur Edson, director of cinematography. What does the director of cinematography do again, Zach, for listeners who are listening for the first time?
It would be lighting, props, but not really props.
Lighting.
A lot of lighting stuff.
Yeah.
Putting the camera in place.
Yep. Movie that he worked on in 1941, The Maltese Falcon.
Ooh, very nice.
When you know that, and this is, we should have made this month Humphrey Bogart month and just watched Maltese Falcon and Casablanca and Treasure of the Sierra Madre and just put them all together because... What's really crazy, and this gets into what we were talking about earlier this week on the Major Spoilers podcast, when we were talking about the potential director for Doctor Strange, how directors bring and directors of photography bring what they know from film to film to film. And there are striking similarities between the shots and the lighting used in The Maltese Falcon and reused again in Casablanca. There's a great, you know, one of them that'll pop out in most people's minds is we know in The Maltese Falcon, there's this shot where the light streaming through the window and you see Archer and Spade from the window cast as a shadow on the floor. That happens in this movie, too, in the exact same framing, in the exact same way. Edson or Edison uses lighting that's really impossible in the real world, like lights down below casting shadows upwards to create a lot of texture in the background. I find really interesting, but man, I am totally sucked into the whole lighting style of this movie.
Yeah.
This movie, when it comes to lighting, has got to be one of the best lit movies I have ever seen. Now, the bad thing is it calls attention to itself.
Oh, yeah, it does.
But it is so well done because of the way that he does this depth of lighting throughout the entire scene, to where, you know, the biggest scene that we talk about is when Rick is drunk and Sam is playing, and then she walks in a little bit later on. From the very first moment, Rick is lit. I mean, he's in darkness, because this is really the only time he's lit dark in the whole movie. And then you've got darkness behind him. You got a little bit of rim light so that he's separated from the dark background. Then you've got Sam that's lit, and then you've got some more darkness, but it's cut through by the light from the airport sweeping through the scene. And then way, 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 way back, you got a light hitting just in the right spot to illuminate the doorway.
Mm-hmm.
And just throughout the whole movie, obviously you can only do this in a set because you have complete control over the lighting. This could not have been done on any kind of location shoot. but the lighting in this is just blows me away each and every time. Have any thoughts on this, Rodrigo?
Yeah, I think it has real kind of theatrical lighting. And it does it to great effect. And you're right, it does kind of call attention to itself. Like, I probably, there's this moment where Rick and Renault are talking, and Rick walks over to get something, and all of a sudden you see his silhouette up against the light. And it's kind of the only time it happens in the movie. And I it's emphasizing something important, but it works and it looks good, but also it's very obvious,
right?
You know,
there's a,
it's like, look at this cool shot all of a sudden.
And I think it does that a lot when it goes in for the tight shots. They're doing the flashback in Paris, was the most notable I think I can remember, or maybe they're in Rick's apartment, I don't remember. They do a tight up of Elsa, and so they have, I mean, throughout the whole movie, all the tights up are like super beauty glam shots.
Well, with her, they're definitely soft
super
focus.
Super rim light on her head, soft focus, and she just looks, I mean, she looks fantastic on the screen. And then they pull back to the two shot, and it's kind of muted, and there's no way that lighting was even possible in this room. and that happens a lot throughout this, I thought, especially with Elsa. And then other characters can, Rick gets every once in a while too, but that the rim lights just go crazy on the tights. And then you pull back like, well, where'd all that crazy light go?
And that's the thing is, like, it's not just that they're setting up a scene and then zooming in and zooming out.
Right.
Oh, no.
Because obviously, there's no zoom. I mean, trucking in and trucking out. Yeah. They are, each individual shot is its own little tableau. And then they just kind of go back and forth with that.
There is a great analysis that I think you should read. It's over at guruoffilm.com, where the writer goes in and just goes into an in-depth analysis about what the lighting means in every scene. Why in all the rest of the movie do we see Rick, we see his face lit evenly and brightly, yet in this one scene where he's drunk, it's completely dark and it breaks it down. And then you can go online and you can find some lighting diagrams of how they lit certain scenes in the movie. And I think if you want to go in and study lighting, this is a film to really see how they do that. Now, granted, again, it's a studio film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is totally not realistic. You couldn't do something like that in a location, because, you know, you've got ceilings in locations.
Yeah.
You don't have a 10K.
You have ceilings.
You don't have a 10K light, you know, a two stories up, lighting up the hallway and the room so that everybody has a nice room light on them.
Yeah.
I mean, just don't have that.
Yeah.
But, so I would go check out guruoffilm.com. Yeah, it has a really good article.
The lighting struck me a lot. And in this movie in particular, I thought the use of camera movements and then just the well of placing everyone really struck me in this. There's a lot of scenes where we're kind of right in the cafe, the first part of the movie, and Rick's given an order and he's with the police guy. And so they're kind of pulled out with three guys at a table and the waiter, and everything's framed nice and evenly. Everyone's in the quadrant, and they truck in, and it just becomes Rick and policeman. And so there was a lot of camera movement, I thought, in this, which was kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, a lot of dolly.
There's a lot of dollying in, a lot of trucking around, which made it really feel interesting. And just the placing of people, I thought, was really well in this. And this felt like a transitional phase between filming a stage play and kind of moving into experimenting what we can do with film.
So again, remember, these are Europeans and they're bringing in very European style. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about film noir and we talk about the movie M, those people who are working in Germany, who are working in France, who are working in Poland and all these places in Europe are now in America and they're able to take they've been bringing from America to here. This is actually a very and again, you'll read this over at the Guru of Film article. He claims that this is a noir film just in the way that it's lit and the way that it's shot and the angles that are used compared. And again, Maltese Falcon is certainly that. But this is almost a way of bridging the popularity of noir in modern America cinema into modern America cinema. Even though we did have the Maltese Falcon, you kind of have to have that shooting style for a detective story. But here in a love story, you can bring noir into this setting. Works really, really well.
Well, and it's a great example of it's just a group of film techniques, right? Give you a very sharp looking, like sharp, tight looking movie, right? And it just so happens that they work really well for mystery and they work really well for detective stuff. So noir became synonymous with the detective movie because it worked so well. And because anytime somebody wanted to do a detective film, then they went and they copied the Maltese Falcon.
Right.
And Casablanca to a certain degree. But it's kind of like you ever watch Saturday Night Live or like any show and they do a parody of a game show from like the 60s or 70s and they play that like it's like that's not game show music, that's the music they were into at the time and they just are like, oh, this sounds cool, this will make my game show sound good.
Right.
But it has in retrospect become game show music because it's game shows are the only places where that music survives.
Right. It's going to be like in 20 years, dubstep's only going to be associated with like extreme sport videos, bike videos, power skateboard running videos.
Absolutely. Creatures. And it's like you can shoot a love story in a noir style and not even be like, why isn't there any detective work happening here? You know, I mean, you can do it. Maybe now you can't. Maybe now you would be fighting your audience on it. But when this was first happening, you know, it's like you can, you know, maybe back in like 2000, you could have put bullet time stuff in a romantic comedy and people would have just been like, yeah, bullet time's cool. It doesn't necessarily mean action or whatever.
Right.
I mean, that's true because before that, you saw it in like music videos and stuff and it wasn't necessarily The Matrix. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of that same thing we ran into with Rocky is they're putting together what would become the building blocks of that noir style here. And even though there are movies that predate this, I think that a lot of what we know of noir movies is actually not necessarily from here, but definitely influenced by this movie.
Well, and actually Rocky is a great example because the technique that is montage has existed for 100 years before Rocky. Right? But Rocky did something to it. Rocky turned it into that passage of time training montage. And nowadays, that's almost the only thing that you see a montage for other than like trying out like Night on the Town, like trying out clothes type montages makeover type stuff.
Yeah.
And it is really kind of the same thing too, is that kind of self-improvement montage. And that's kind of like Rocky took that and like accidentally in the process of making a good movie codified it into something that was so strong and so specific that now it's difficult not to think of it that way. And in a way, the Maltese Falcon did that to that noir style.
Speaking of Rocky, last week we were talking about how movies get on these lists and these kinds of things. And we were talking about the American Film Institute and how they come up with the list and what goes on. I was doing some more research on the National Film Registry. You just do some minor searching. You know, this is run by the Library of Congress. And so the Librarian of Congress is the one who ultimately and his group of people, his committee, ultimately make the decision on which films will be allowed in. But here's the interesting thing. Anyone can nominate any movie to be considered a national treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So American films, obviously, because we're talking about American cinema. Right, and that's what the National Film Preservation Board is very interested in. But every year they open it up and people can submit films. Now, the films have to be I think the films have to be at least 10 years old before you can nominate them. Okay. So here's what they say. The Library in Congress, James H. Billington, who's been there since 1987, he's the longest running Librarian of Congress ever. To be eligible for the registry, a film must be at least 10 years old and culturally, historically, or aesthetically aesthetically significant. And then it talks about the establishment. This 625 films to date have been added in, and for consideration, you have to limit it to 50 titles per year, but you can forward your recommendations to dross@loc.gov, and you can submit up to 50 titles per year to be considered.
A letter about surf Nazis must die right now.
But here's the thing. So people can, you can submit surf Nazis must die if you like, Matthew, but here's the thing.
And Team America World Police.
But here's the thing. Even if 1,000 people submit it, ultimately then this board will say, okay, of the movies that were submitted this year, here are the top 50 of them that have the most votes. And maybe Surf Nazis Must Die is in that list. Then they have to go through and they have to consider, do these meet we consider to be a part of this? Now, I'm going to leave that story there because I've got a line on the person who's in charge, not really the Librarian of Congress, although that's who I was hoping that I could talk to. But I've got a line on someone at the Library of Congress who will hopefully share some more information on this. And hopefully I will have that for next week. I've got his phone number here. I didn't have a chance to call him this week because I tried calling on Friday. Everybody was already out of town.
Sure.
But I got his name. I've got his number. I'm going to give him a call, see if we can get him on maybe next week, if possible, to where he can just talk about this entire process. I don't know if he'll talk about who the makeup of the board is, how many films that they actually consider, what are the other things that they have to consider in doing it. But any film can be nominated by anybody. So it's really American citizens, well, people in America nominating these movies. So, Rodrigo, if you want to nominate a movie, by all means, you've got the dross@loc.gov.
Well,
you can start submitting movies and maybe they will get.
Yeah, I mean, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey is more than 10 years old. So.
Yeah, that's true. There you go. There you go. And they do point out that your voice is important. And that's why they solicit
10 years old.
Opinions from people.
Talking
my voice is
talking
important.
Matrix and all those good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Phantom Menace
Matrix.
Is up for consideration.
Matrix will
now?
Probably make it sooner rather than later.
Oh, I'm sure Matrix will eventually.
I don't think Phantom Menace will.
Well, so, and again, it goes in a little bit more. The Librarian of Congress, after reviewing public suggestions and considering extensively with film experts and the 44 members of the Film Preservation Board, select 25 films a year to be included in the registry. So even though there are tens of thousands of movies that have been made since 1901, only 25 get to make it into the list each year. Now, you can, you know, just because it doesn't make it this year doesn't mean you can't nominate it again next year.
Sure.
But I think this is the thing that people don't realize is that, hey, I have a voice that I can submit and say this movie does need to be considered.
That is interesting.
So hopefully I will have somebody on next week and we can talk in depth with that person and see, maybe get a half hour.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Yeah. And that way people can learn more about it.
Absolutely.
And the more you know, the more you know.
That was beautiful.
Hey.
Okay, Zach, wrap it up.
Okay, that'll be it for this week on Zach on Film. Make sure you head over to majorspoilers.com where you can click on that podcast posting page and give all your thoughts about what we've discussed this week about Casablanca or any thoughts you have of your own about Casablanca. Make sure to click on that amazon.com link while you're there at Major Spoilers. You can go buy your very own copy of Casablanca or any other films that we've talked about on Zach on Film. It's not going to cost you any extra. But a little bit will come back to the site to keep us going week after week so we can continue bringing more free content to you every week. Next week, we will be talking Snatch on Zach on Film.
Get all the MasterForce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with MasterForce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with MasterForce power equipment at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.